Thank you. Well, it is my very, very, very great honor to introduce Venerable Panawati. I want to tell you a little bit about her. There's a lot to say, but I won't say a lot because I've already been chewed out more than once for going on and on and on about a monastic. So I'm not going to say a lot, but I'm going to say some important things. I first met Venerable when I was doing the CDL. I know I'm going back a little far, but just to set the stage for what I'm going to say. Met her when I was at CDL. First time I had never seen a black monastic. And she was so dynamic that she really just, I think that CDL, we had 100 people in the room, and she just moved us all into this inspiration in the Dhamma. Very inspiring. And since then, that was way back in 2011, she has been my teacher and my friend ever since then. She's a longtime supporter of SIMS, used to come regularly every year and do a non-residential for us. And so we're very happy that this is the first non-residential, and it happens to be her. Okay, good. She's happy too. So her teachings are rooted in Theravadin and Mahayana traditions in Buddhism. And she is, I think, probably the only one that I know that's ordained in the monastic tradition. And so both as a Theravadin nun, monk and a Mahayana monk. And so there's a uniqueness and a specialness about the way she delivers the Dhamma. It's very deep, and yet it's very powerful and inspiring. It's funny. And it is accessible completely. So even though we're going to talk about emptiness, Marilyn, you don't have nothing to worry about. You'll be fine. You're in good company. We will all understand emptiness at a whole different level. So thank you so much for being here. I'm going to sit to the side because Venerable is going to play some music, and I'm the one that's going to be doing the mic for that. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for coming out tonight. I'm sitting over here trying to realize the emptiness myself right now because I have the music on here, but it looks like it's a lot of them. So I don't know if some of them are scratched, but I sent a note, heads are going to roll if they are. I would like to thank you for inviting me. I took3-year hiatus, and then there was 3 years of, ooh, it's a long time. 3 years of COVID shut down, and then I sort of like didn't come back. I'm old and my time is winding up. And to tell you the truth, there's no purpose for me being in this world, except to save living beings. Now, it's not because I'm old, but because I can see clearly now. And there's something about clear seeing that gives you a sense of urgency. But in order to act on that urgency, what's my topic?
What's her emptiness.
Okay, yeah. So what happens is they ask you for a topic like 4 or 5 months in advance. I mean, like, how do you really know? I mean, it's something about being present in the moment to receive the signal, to know what's needed for the people that are sitting in the room. Like, I don't have a clue, you know? So I just give them something, and I talk about that a little bit while I'm here. But it'll all come together in the way that it should. Don't go far.
I'm just gonna sit right here.
Okay. And so I'm thinking about what I should do with the rest of my life. And I went into a certain state, because that's what we're going to be talking about this weekend, how to enter into a particular state so that something becomes real to you. You have a realization of it. It's not something that can be known apart from entering into that state. That state gives you access to that reality. And so I was sitting there thinking, you know, ordinary mind, just thinking, and I entered a state. And in this state, it was like we call it a bardo. But I wasn't here, and I wasn't there, wherever there is after being here. I wasn't here, and I wasn't there. But I was captured and caught up in some kind of a state. And this state was luminous, but there wasn't anything I could do in terms of thinking in this state. I could only experience the state. And that state was without any kind of discomfort. It was also without any kind of elation. I was not happy and I was not sad. It was just an equanimous state. And I was in that state for a while. When I say while, I mean a while. for days. And finally, my master, who had left this world a year earlier, appeared to me in there. He said, "Well, what you gonna do?" He said, "You coming, you going, what?" And I said, "I don't know." I said, "If there's some usefulness for me, I'll stay. If it's not, then I'll get on with the next thing." And so I said, "What do you think I should do?" He said, "It's not my life, it's yours." But because he appeared to me there, I got an idea that maybe there was still something left. And so I said, "I will stay." And then I came out of it. Now, I actually had some experience in that state, but my ordinary mind could not decipher it. It couldn't put it together, because some of the things that occurred in that state were too wonderful for my low mind to apprehend. But I knew I'd had some kind of experience. I mean, real experience. If we say that the Buddha was an enlightened one, and he's come to share something with, what is he coming to share with us? How to be happier with our things? What is he coming to share with us? I mean, what was the purpose? Think about what the Dharma means to you, what Buddhism means to you, what the practice means to you. And do you think that that's what a Buddha, if we accept that he was a fully enlightened one, and some of us just may not, and that's okay. But if we do, what do you think he came to teach us or to show us or to guide us to? Do you think it is as low level as we think in a general, you know, in a general way? Or would this be something that was really high and beyond our capacity to figure out on our own? You know, what would he be coming for? I mean, I'm throwing it out. What do you think his purpose for revealing this path was for? It's not a quick a trick question. It's just a question. Oh, you know what? I forgot to open up. I'm going to open up in a minute. So it's not a trick question, but I want you to think and see what you come up with. No wrong answer. To alleviate suffering. Oh, that's really vague. I mean, that's a winning answer, right? give me some more. Yes.
To liberate the mind.
Okay. Give me somebody else. Yes.
Liberate
us from what?
Tools
to live with. Okay, yes.
To share a path.
To share a path. Okay.
To know what happiness is.
To know what happiness is. Okay.
To illuminate and to sow
a beginning of an
awareness that
there's a lot more to our lives than what we
think there is. Okay, great.
And
that it's amazing. What
really is all to
experience and
fullness
of all that we are.
Okay, thank you.
Repeat that.
Oh, they don't hear you?
Yeah.
I need to repeat it.
Normally people will
okay.
Come up and use the mic. It's okay.
Okay.
So just repeat, just to paraphrase that.
All right. To show, I'm going to paraphrase it, that in this world with all of its troubles, there is the possibility of a marvelous existence. Anyone else? Yes. What we seek is already within us. Okay, so how many believe everything that they said? Everybody, okay. So I think that the Buddha came to point us to our own intrinsic Buddha nature that wasn't just him. One of his disciples said, is anybody awake besides you? And he said, yeah, I have 500 monks. I have 500 nuns. I have 500 male lay disciples, 500 female lay disciples. And all of them have awakened. And so Vajragatha said, oh, good, then I'll join your group, because if it was just you, I wouldn't be interested. So I want to ask, how many of us think that the possibility of awakening to our Buddha nature is available to us in this very life? Okay. Okay. Well, I'm going to put you to the test this week, then. I'm going to hold you to those hands. Let me see those hands again. I think that's almost everybody in the room. Okay, so why don't we open up? And this is going to be a mandala offering. This is our mandala for the next couple of days. And in a mandala offering, we are offering, we're creating a boundary. And within this boundary, we are offering all of the treasures of our heart to the accomplished ones, the foe destroyers, those who have overcome suffering, those who have awakened, for being an example for us, for laying the foundation for our own awakening, our growth, our development.
And it's basically saying that all that the merit that we earn, we're willing to share with all beings so that all beings may realize enlightenment. And we're thinking about the space here and how it was used before. And we're thinking about the people who came in for services. And someone said, you know, maybe there's some lingering energies in this room. But what I would hope is that there are some lingering minds in this room. And I invite them to come now and hear this wonderful Dharma. And after that invitation, we offer all of our physical actions and our speech, our thoughts, our wealth, our good fortune in the past, in the present, and in future lifetimes, and wonderful treasures to the three jewels. We ask them to compassionately accept our offerings, and I will do a mind seal with that. And then we're going to invite the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas in the 10 directions, past, present, and future, to come and be present with us. Someone asked the question about worship. You know, like I think of worship is ascribing worth to. So it wouldn't be the worship in the sense that you are begging for something, or you are considering yourself as I'm so unworthy and you're asking, but it is recognizing that we have friends in high places. We have friends who are not just human beings. You know, it would be a shame to create the whole universe for us, and that to think that we could be the highest consciousness or mind, we could have the highest mind stream in all the universe. We can just look at what we're doing in the world and think, no, that's probably not true. So there are many, many worlds. There are many, many beings. There are many, many classifications. There are many, many realms. They're innumerable. They're vast and without limit. Some good, some not so good. I went to China one time, and you know, you have a map, and map tells you, you know, they have these guides books. It's a Chinese guidebook. And you can use that guidebook and try to get around. But I'm going to tell you, it's better to have a living guide. And this is kind of what we have. We have living guides. If we know how to connect in a certain way. I had so many of Tawari's books off the shelf because I was thinking, I'm like, no, I'm going to be talking in a particular way, and they're going to think this stuff is not in the Theravada Sutras. But are they in there, Tawari? They're in there. Maybe all of it didn't translate. You have to remember that when the Dharmas first started coming into this country, they were leaving the churches, the synagogues, the mosques, and in droves, because there was something about the religiosity that just was not, people were looking for something else. So there's no point in going to the East and coming back and bringing something else that even resembled that. You know, so they started teaching about other things and other levels, introductory ways that we can come and understand the nature of reality. And that took hold. But that's like learning the alphabet and then don't go on to form words with the characters. It's like forming words but don't go on to craft sentences. And it's like having sentences that you don't put together into a cohesive story and make into paragraphs and write novels. All of it is needed, but all of it is not of the same level of engagement. And so I'm going to share some things this weekend that might be a little bit different. But you know, the Buddha only taught the Dharma. And the patriarchs of old had groups of people from different places, different cultures, you know, different levels of understanding. And they taught whoever was in front of them according to their capacity to receive. If I was, I've started to say preaching too. If I was talking to a group of people who had recently stepped out of the church, just because, well, something was working, but something wasn't working, you know, or they'd had some other realization, I had one, you know, then I might talk to them from the frame of reference that they are familiar with, as opposed to talking to them through the lens of Hindu practice. But if I was talking to Hindus, I would talk to them through the lens of what they've already experienced and learned in Hindu practice, as opposed to what Muslims understood. You see? And so in time, you have all of these different ways of approaching the one Dharma, but from a perspective that you can start and take a person on to the next step. And so it becomes digestible, becomes reasonable. We can use our reasoning and our intellect to analyze, and we can grow. So it's not to confuse, but it's to help each one of us take the next step. Now, what's so fantastic about the Dharma is that it has this capacity. That's why you know it's more than what our scattered intelligence can come up with. They call it the prajna, and we've translated prajna to mean wisdom, but it's not a worldly kind of wisdom. You're not going to be able to think this up in your head. Reasoning is not going to be able to go there. But even the Buddha said, I can't exactly tell you what it is, but I can tell you this, it can be experienced. And so we know this, not through our intellect, but through direct experience. So let me do the mandala offering now. And did you have, yes. Okay, and I'm gonna give this back to you, okay.
You want me to?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And what I want you to do is just to walk in each corner.
Okay.
One, two, three, four. Bones out above your home, bones out right here home, bones to move around the walk. To seven is to the universe, all churches in the universe of the blue soul. Great marathon, I am right now, I'm going to share all of you. Beings out in all the scattered streets, who have good fortune, his present and future lifetimes, and wonderful treasures to the master, yet of an infinite, many compassionate, accept our offerings, thereby power us. Mom, Sava, the Dagda, Edom, Rana, Guru, Nyaya, Tayami, Guru, Sava, of this Mount Dalo. Bhakta Sada Samaya, Manu Banaya, Bhakta Sada, And so we have made our offering to the holy beings, and the meditation song is Here Is in Heaven.
Your light surrounds us.
So I'm going to start with Sutta 128. Sutta 128 was a gathering of some of the Buddha's disciples. And he was with a group, but they were carrying on in their usual fashion. There was quarreling and brawling and wrangling and disputing, and everybody had their own opinion about things. And he said, it's not good to dispute like this. He said, we should blend like milk and water. And so they just kept on. They said, look, Buddha, we got this. You're a visitor in our camp. You know, we can handle our own business. And he went a second time, and he went to them a third time. And so finally he got up, and he got his bowl and his robe, and he went down the road. And this is what he said. He abused me, he struck me, he defeated me, he robbed me. And those who harbor thoughts like this, hatred will not be allayed. For in this world, hatred is never allayed by further acts of hate. It is allayed by non-hatred. That is a fixed and an ageless law. So those others do not recognize that here we should restrain ourselves, but those wise ones who realize this at once end all of their enmity. So if one can find a worthy friend, virtuous and steadfast companion, then overcome all threats of danger and walk with him content and mindful. But if one finds no worthy friend, no virtuous, steadfast companion, then as a king leaves his conquered realm, walk like a tusker alone in the woods. It is better to walk alone. There's no companionship with fools. Walk alone and do no evil, at ease like a tusker in the woods. And so after he made that utterance, he walked on down the road. And there was a guard guarding a section of the forest, and he perceived that he had some disciples over there. He said, I'll go hang out with them for a while. And when he went, the guard said, you can't go in. These are the Buddha's disciples meditating. But they perceived that that was their teacher. And he said, oh, let him in. He's our teacher. And so he went in. And it was Anuruddha and a few other disciples there, and they were studying and practicing and discussing, and they were meditating together. And he said, Anuruddha, I hope that you all abide diligent, ardent, and resolute. He said, Venerable Sir, we do. He said, well, how do you do that? He said, whichever one of us gets up first, goes out to the village and gets food, alms food. The next one prepares the seats and sets out water for drinking and washing. Somebody else puts the refuse bucket in place. And whoever returns last eats whatever food is left over. And if we've eaten it all and there's none that's left over, he just cleans up the kitchen. He said, so that's how That's how we do it. He said, now, if one person has a job and it's too much, he doesn't have to ask for help because we'll notice that it's heavy. And somebody will go over and pick up one end of the, what did they call it? Whoever notices that the pots of water for drinking or the latrine are low or empty, he just takes care of it. If it's too heavy for him, he calls someone else by signaling, but they don't even have to talk. They just join hands. And because of this, you know, we do not break out in speech, but every 5 days we sit together all night talking and discussing the Dhamma. That's how we abide diligent, ardent, and resolute. He said, good, good, Anuruddha. But while you abide thus diligent, ardent, and resolute, have you attained any superhuman states, a distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of noble ones, worthy of noble ones, a comfortable abiding? He said, Venerable Sir, yeah, we abide here, diligent, ardent, and resolute. We perceive both light and the vision of forms. But soon afterwards, the light and the vision of forms disappear. But we have not discovered the cause for that. He said, you should discover the cause for that, Anuruddha. Before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, I too perceived both light and a vision of forms. But soon after, the light and the vision of forms disappeared. And I thought, what is the cause and condition why the light and the vision of forms disappears? And then I considered, doubt arose in me. And because of doubt, my concentration fell away. And when my concentration fell away, the light and the vision of forms disappeared. So I shall act so that doubt will not arise in me again. And Anuruddha, as I was abiding diligent, ardent, and resolute, I perceived both light and a vision of forms. And soon after, the light and the vision of forms disappeared. And I thought, what is the cause and condition why the light and the vision of forms have disappeared? Then I considered thus, inattention arose in me. And because of inattention, my concentration fell away. And when it fell away, the light and the vision of forms disappeared. I'll act so that neither doubt nor inattention will arise. And Anuruddha, while I was abiding diligent, ardent, and resolute, I perceived both light and the vision of forms, but sloth and torpor arose in me. And because of that, my concentration fell away and the visions disappeared. So I shall act that neither doubt nor inattention nor sloth and torpor will arise in me. And Anuruddha, while I was abiding diligent, same story. Fear arose in me the next time he meditated. And because of fear, his concentration fell away. So the next time he was meditating, elation arose in him. And his concentration fell away. And the vision and the forms disappeared. The next time he was meditating, inertia arose. And the next time he was meditating, excess of energy arose in him. The next time he was meditating, deficiency of energy arose in him. And the next time, longing arose in him. I'm saving you some of the repetitions. You'll appreciate this. Okay. And then the next time, perception of diversity arose in him. And the next time, excessive meditation upon forms arose in him. And Anna Ruta, I understood that doubt is the imperfection of the mind. And I abandoned doubt. Inattention, sloth and torpor, fear, elation, inertia, excess of energy, deficiency of energy, longing, perception of diversity, excess meditation upon forms, all of them were imperfections of the mind. I abandoned them one by one. And he said, I understood thereupon, Anna Ruta, that if I could develop concentration with applied thought, sustained thought, then I could develop concentration without applied thought, but just sustained thought. Then I could develop concentration with rapture. I could develop concentration without rapture. I could develop concentration accompanied by equanimity. And when I was able to do all of these things, then I realized my deliverance is unshakable. This is my last birth. There is no renewal of being. And this is what the Blessed One said. Now, you look at the two groups of disciples. The first one, they were bickering and they were full of opinions and they just couldn't come together, couldn't agree on anything. And so they made no progress in their meditation. The second group, they blended like milk and water. He said when one wanted something, they were so in tune with each other that they could perceive what the need was and they could move right to it. It wasn't thinking like, I'm not helping him. He didn't help me with my job. No. He's talking about a way that we flavor the mind so that we can enter into a certain state that has super mundane, super normal qualities. You know, wicked people, bad people, they are pretty sure that their badness works. Good people, we're not so sure that our goodness works. So when they're doing what they do, what they believe in, what they uphold, what they stand for, they do a really good job of being bad because they have confidence that it's going to work. It's going to get them what they want. But those of us who are good, we don't have that much confidence in our goodness. And so we need to first arouse faith in the power of goodness. It takes a certain kind of fearlessness to be able to overcome the wickedness in the world. Now, this is the beginning stage. Then come down to the end, and we find that it's all on one tandem. Good, the highest good, to evil, and the greatest wickedness. It's all of one kind. It's just where on that tandem you are. But in the beginning, we start with good and evil, harmless and harmful. And we have to put it into practice in a certain way. Not, I'm going to be good to those who are good to me, and the ones who are not good to me, I'm not going to be good to them either. He says, that's the way we already think with our deluded minds. He says, what I'm saying to you is to the one who's not good to you, be good to that one. To the one that is good to you, also be good to that one. And this is where the practice starts to get a little difficult, because we can talk it out. We know what we should do, how we should be. But in the moment of walking it out, it's a little bit more difficult. So we will do what we do and say, I got to go sit down and meditate. You know, I got to get my mind together. I got to, you know, and that's what we do. But the work is done in the moment when the unwholesomeness is arising. So one of your greatest practices can be to accommodate a slight, tolerate a fault. That's where you're going to grow the most. That's where your patience is going to be perfected. You know, like when I was a Christian, the Bible said that patience comes with persecution. I said, forget that one. I went for some other ones that were pretty good, but I wasn't interested in patience. But you know, the time comes that you just have to face the music, right? So I reached that time where I had to begin to work on patience. I couldn't go any further. There are some realms, some states that you can't enter into them without possessing the qualities that open the door, that let you in that space. And so we might be doing all of our recitations and we're great scholars of the Dhamma, but I didn't really see where he praised scholars that much. He praised practitioners who practiced well. But we have a sort of a different view of it now. But we have to get back to practicing well. And practicing well is going to require a faith in the Dhamma that the benefit is there. There is some benefit. There is some merit for taking up the walk. Now, if you say that there is for you, I don't know that there really is for you. I only know what I experience with you. No? That's the only, no, I can't get in your head and know it like you know it. I can't get in your eyes and see it like you see it. I only know it through my own lens and what I observe. Right? How you? And so this becomes our challenge. How will we walk out what we say we understand? And so the hardest part, it's easy to do whatever you do throughout the day and think, oh, I shouldn't have said that. I shouldn't have done it. I'm going to try to do better next time. You know, it's easy to go home and sit and whew, I just need to take a minute and but what we've already done, we've done. And we have set something in motion that's going to bear its fruit. And when that time comes, even though you're generally a good person, when that time comes, that fruit that you planted is going to sprout. And you can't say, but I'm a good girl, I am. Most of the time, it was just like that one time, you know. Ah. But when that comes up, know that there's no way that that fruit could have come up except that you planted the seed. Suppose in this mind stream, you know, we don't think we like just popped out of our mother's womb and there was a human, right? We don't think we just like did a genie blink and we became people. Right, we know that there is some cause that produces an appearance in this world at this time, in this form. We may not know what it is, but the Buddha says that there was an action, and for every action, there is a result. And if I die and I have initiated an action and the result hasn't matured, then like a candle whose wick has burned down, lighting another candle, and now there's a new candle and wick. This one out, this one continues on. And it's something like that in the way that we come forward into this world at this time, you know, with a certain mind stream suitable for the fruit that's ripening. And that's how all beings come into existence. And so here I am now. Something's ripening and it has produced a form suitable for its ripening. But I didn't do it. It was that other being. It wasn't me. And so I have some confusion then about like why I'm paying the price for what somebody else did. You know, past life. I don't know anything about past life. I only know about here and now. So he says, okay, well, just look at here and now. Here and now you see cause and effect. Everywhere. It is a universal law. Cause and effect. So he says, that's the world you live in. You don't want to be in this world? There are other worlds to be in. Some of these worlds aren't governed by the law of cause and effect, but this one is. And so one begins to have some inquisitiveness about how this world really works. And what is my hope? What is my way of escape? And so he begins to teach line by line, precept by precept, here a little, there a little. And every time we understand one thing, he starts to go a little deeper until he gets all the way to the end. And I'm going to go to the back of the book now, and I'm going to read you what the end is. This is the Prajna Paramita Heart Sutra. This is the end of the story. All that you can realize through this practice. Said Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when practicing deeply, Prajna Paramita illuminated the five aggregates and saw that they were all empty and crossed beyond all suffering and adversity. How did she cross beyond all suffering and adversity? She illuminated the five aggregates and saw that they were all empty. What's the five aggregates? The form? Okay, so form, feeling, perception, consciousness, and mental formations, which produce our actions, right? That's what we are. We are this amalgamation of a physical form, feelings, consciousness, thoughts, actions. When they come together, are compounded, it creates a phenomena for, in our case, human being. For something else, a mosquito. No. But based on our emerging karma, this is our state, human being. But he says that form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. And the same is true of feeling, conceptualization, action, and consciousness. So emptiness, Shariputra, is the characteristic of all Dharma. It does not arise or perish. It's not defiled or pure. Does not increase or decrease. Therefore, in emptiness, there is no form. There is no feeling. There is no conceptualization. There is no action or consciousness. There is no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no forms, no sounds, no smells, no tastes, no touches, nor objects of mind, no realm of eyes, up to and including no realm of mind consciousness, no avidya, that means ignorance, and also no ending of avidya, up to and including no aging and death, and no ending of aging and death, no suffering, no accumulation, no cessation, and no path, no wisdom, and no attainment, with nothing to attain. Therefore, bodhisattvas rely on prajna paramita, and thus their minds have no hindrance. Because there's no hindrance, they have no fear. Having forever left inverted dream-like thinking, they dwell here and now in ultimate nibbana. All Buddhas of the three times rely on this wisdom, and thereby attain anuttara samyak sambodhi. Therefore, know that the prajna paramita is the great supernormal mantra, the great bright mantra, the supreme mantra, the unequaled mantra, which can remove all suffering and is true, not false. So recite the prajna paramita mantra. Recite the mantra that says, Gati, Gati, Paragati, Parasamgati, Bodhi, Swaha. So my hope for this weekend is that I give you an introductory understanding of the absolute truth of the universe and human life to realize the state of one who can transcend the ordinary and enter the holiness of the Bodhi mind, the awakened mind. Now that's a tall story. But that's what the Buddha came to do. To understand this a little bit, you need to know a little something about the Buddhist cosmology. 31 planes of existence. Who knows? Okay. The 31 planes starting, you know, with the hell realms, ending with the pure lands, right? And so you have beings in the hell realm or plane of unimaginable suffering. You have beings in the hungry ghost realm. You have beings in the asura realm. You have beings in the animal realm, you have beings in the human realm, you have beings in the deva realms, you have beings in the god realms, and there's a number of them, and they all come up to be 31 planes. And he says that there is a reason why we are in whichever plane we're in. And he says that when we perfect the meditation, now I'm going to tell you where meditation is going. When you perfect the meditation, it allows you access to higher realms of existence, realms that are not like this one that we're in. And so he begins to give us a way to shift the mind, to train the mind so that it becomes suitable for an elevation. Now, we're here in this world. Yeah? And when this body falls away, when there's a separation of the elements of the earth, the air, fire, and water, because that's what we are, compound of earth, air, fire, and water, right? Well, that's our elemental, our body, earth, air, fire, and water. And then we also have a mental aggregate, so he calls us mind-body. We're mind body. So we have pleasures in the physical body that's made of earth elements. And then we have pleasures in the mind. And because we are accustomed to these pleasures in the body and the pleasures in the mind that we like, we get perturbed, agitated, upset, angry, sorrowful when we have the opposite effect, when something happens that we don't want to happen, when somebody goes that we want them to stay, when somebody stays and we want them to leave, when something that you want is given to somebody else, when the praise you deserved, somebody else got it. You know, anything that doesn't suit that which gives us pleasure gives us a sense of suffering. So in the beginning, we start talking about that. And we start noticing what agitates. And sometimes in our contemplations, we're observing, we're becoming aware of what agitates us. And we start to realize that if we can just be with that without grasping around it, then maybe we won't feel so bad. I could say, don't sweat the small stuff. That doesn't bother me. And we start to find a bit of relief with that. And so we think that that's it. That's all we have to do the rest of our life. Like, just change our mind about how we feel about something. And we think, I've done my work. But all that will do is keep us rolling in the cycle of samsara. And he was talking to us about a way out of samsara. He said, the first thing you need to know is, while you think I am the Buddha and the only Buddha, you have the same intrinsic nature that I have. That means that you have the capacity to awaken to your own Buddha nature. And that Buddha nature is basically empty. Empty in the sense of there is nothing there compounded, creating something. And so I can't understand. I can't understand that. How can something come from nothing? I don't understand. I don't understand the language. And he says, oh, you're not going to be able to figure this out in your mind. But once you experience it, you will know what it is. And so he begins to give us methods whereby we can experience. But we're intellectual folk. We like to talk about what we think it is and what it means and put our words together. But it's no, just experience. Follow my instructions and you will awaken to something that is indescribable, that is without measure, that brings unspeakable joy, that brings a kind of self-mastery that you can live in this world and yet not be of this world. And he says, do you want it? And they would say, yes, we do. And he said, come, follow me. And so he would take us step by step through a series of processes. When you come tomorrow, I hope you have earplugs. And I hope you have an eye mask. Because right now, I hear all kinds of sounds. I hear the, what is that, the air conditioner thing, you know? I hear some frequencies, don't you hear? Mm-hmm. Now, just take a minute and just put your thumbs in your ears to a count of five, and then take them out. Was that different than sitting without your thumbs in your ears? Yeah. What was the difference in the experience? What did you notice?
An absence of sound.
Absence of sound. Good. What else?
It felt stiller.
Stiller. Yeah. What else?
Less distraction.
Less distraction. Great. What else?
I didn't really notice the noise until after I experienced the silence.
Until you took a bow, then you could tell it. Yeah. What else? No, that was no, they don't have to change anything. I was just using it as an example. How many of you felt suddenly that you had turned inward? Mm-hmm. How many sit and meditate in that way? I mask. The reason I wear eye mask is because if I see something, I want to make sure it's not the light coming from right there. You know, I want if something shows up in there, it's going to have to come through pitch black. It's going to have to work its way through the darkest of dark, and I will see what that is. So that's why I wear. Well, actually, I don't have to now anymore. But for years and years, I wore eye mask and this so that I could get to the place that as soon as I sat down and I did that, right in a place where everything falls away. And just sit. That's it. It's an awesome, awesome experience, especially when you first start doing it. Okay. So we're going to be doing sets with an instruction from the Dharma on seeing life as a dream. Because right now it feels like pretty hardcore for real, doesn't it? Yeah. But he says, the easiest way is to see it like a dream. I had a dream one night, just recently. And within the time of the dream, I realized I was dreaming, you know. And then I woke up. When I woke up, my teacher spoke to me and he said, go back into that dream and change it up. So I said, okay. And I immediately went back to sleep and I was right back in that same dream. And I changed something in the dream. And then my night went on, you know, you come out the dream state or whatever and you go into that unconscious state. And then I wake up the next morning. I wake up, I'm so happy. I'm so happy because I just did something. I just went into the dream state and I just changed something around in there. I'm bad. Yeah. So then when I woke up, my teacher said, this is a dream too. It's just longer. He said, it's just longer. He said, change something. I didn't have good success with that, you know. But I'm working on it all the time. Because what he was showing me is that right now we're constantly following phenomena that's happening out here in the outer world, and our mind is changing with it. But he said, the power of a Buddha is outer conditions can change in accordance with his mind. Now, we want all of the good stuff, but we don't want to have to do all the work that allows for that. But that's where practice comes in. and cultivation. We like meditating because it gives us a little break, right? It gives us a little break. But it's cultivation that gives us the capacity to become bodhisattvas and Buddhas. And saving living beings really is our work. And so we take a vow to save living beings. And along with this vow, we take precepts, whichever ones you want to take. You know, you don't have to take a precept until you want to take a precept. It's like you can still study, but when you really feel convinced that you want to take up something, a practice, to be different, then you take that up. So however many people are in this room, you can take 2 precepts, 5 precepts, 8 precepts, 10 precepts, whatever you want to work on. I just recently took up a precept. I was scared to take it before now. And it's called Overcoming Barriers. And in this precept, I take a precept to go to the hardest thing for me to change and take a vow to work on that one first and give myself a certain amount of time. So I don't care what it is, if you steal, if you lie, if you, you know, if you're lazy, whatever it is, and you say, I know I could do better, but I just don't feel like it. Or I'm afraid, if you gamble, you know, I don't want to give that one. I'm going to work on that one last. I'll start with this one right here, and then I'll do this one, and that one last. So this is a particular practice where you take the one that's the most difficult for you, the one that you really don't really want to give up right now, and you vow to give that one up. And, you know, my teacher's a little rough. You all wouldn't be able to take him. But he says, and when you take this vow, you know, if you say, I'm going to give myself 60 days, or I'm going to give myself 30 days, or I'm going to give myself 1 year, whatever time frame you give yourself, then you check and see, did you abandon it? And he says, and if you didn't, you're worse than a dog. You know, and I'm like, oh, well, I don't want to do that one right now. That's a little too tough for me. But one day, I looked for 3 years. And then finally, I said, I'm going to do it. And I took it up. Now, the question is, did I overcome it? The answer is no. I'm still working on it. You know, but I had the courage, the fearlessness to go after the thing that I knew. Now, this thing is not a thing that anybody even knows about me. I'm like, so what's the big deal? You know, nobody even knows this about me. But this is about one's inner integrity, because we all know ourselves. We say, I ain't know I was like that. Yeah, you did, you know, but don't want to work on that. So this is the kind of practice that one takes at the higher levels of training. And what it inures to, though, is a kind of self-mastery. First thing, you come to know yourself altogether, you know. And the only way that you can get through this kind of training is that you have to think about what came before that. Now, that's how we, or where we start to get towards emptiness. What came before that? So we have all of these obscurations. You know, they call it avidya, or they call it ignorance, and we don't like that particular word, but it doesn't mean we're dumb, doesn't mean we're stupid. It's that we have not realized our true nature and what our capacity truly is. We have the capacity to love those who hate us. I remember when, it's been many years now, and we really started getting out with the what you call it, engaged Buddhism. Okay, so I'm black, and you know, I was the only black nun, Theravada nun. I'm still the only one, and now it's almost 30 years. But I hear there is one who's in training, and she's going to be soon. And then we'll be two. And 30 years old. And so all over the place, they want me to come because they want me to speak. They want me to be the spokesman, the token spokesperson for all black people. You know, I'm not all black people. I'm just me, you know. And so I didn't want to do it. And everybody was getting testy because, you know, women are getting testy and black people are getting testy and poor people are getting testy. And everybody's like, feels like, you know, they have a right to rail and to rant. And I said, no, we can't do that because I've taken a vow to be a certain way. You know, my job is loving the unlovely. I might win some. Maybe not all, but I might win some. And so that's all I'm focusing on. Who can I win? And through my own behaviors, through my own speech, through the way I walk out my life, who can I influence? So then I got invited, all the white songers, you know, because they like her because she ain't going to bash nobody. So, like, so I come. And they said, well, we want you to talk to the people of color songer. I'm like, no, I'm not a black Buddhist teacher. I'm a Buddhist teacher. When you want me to talk to your whole sangha, call a sister up. And so they call, and I come. And they say, oh, Panyawadi, how do we get more? We just love people of color. How do we get more people of color in our sangha? I'm like, how many do you know? How many do you hang out with? How many you go to lunch? How many you invite over to y'all? You can't just put up a sign. This is black folks want it. You know? But... you know, but I could say that. And depending on who says it, people could get really offended. But they didn't get offended because my words were in alignment. No, my whole energy was of one kind. That's what I'm saying. So I could say some of the hard things that needed to be said because it wasn't saying one thing and feeling another. Saying one thing and being another. You know, it all lined up. And that's what's called for in this walk. It's a strange kind of integrity, you know. And it starts with one being truthful with their own self. But what you find in this kind of integrity is that one starts to lose oneself. One stops thinking so much about what one wants and what one needs and what one has to have to be comfortable and happy. One starts to take up something that lifts them up in the inward parts in such a way that they don't find so much discontentment in the foolishness that's going on. They don't find so much unhappiness. They are not railroaded by people. They're not perturbed. They're not bothered because there's a certain kind of stillness, a kind of emptiness that they experience that's not constantly clamoring, me, me, my, mine. And it's liberating, I can tell you. It's a kind of freedom that the world can't give you, so the world can't take it from you. So that's one kind of emptiness. And so you go through your day and things are still happening, but it's not bothering you. You come home at the end of the day and you're peaceful and at ease because you ain't hating on nobody. And you start deciding, oh, I can live like this. There was a monk friend of mine, and together we started Heartwood. And in 30 years, we never had one argument. So I just can't, I don't know how people do it, to fight with somebody every day. I just don't understand how you can do it. It hurts my ears to hear it, because I know we don't have to live that way, but it's going to take something. It's going to take seeing oneself as essentially empty. And the practices that we do help us to really come into the fullness of that kind of emptiness. Apart from the cultivation, you cannot enter it, because it's a state, not something you know, but it's a state that you are elevated into that puts you at peace in a certain way that you'd sell everything you have to buy it. Wouldn't it be nice to be able to go through every day like that? And he says that this is possible. In time, you won't sweat the small stuff. No matter how much I examine Panyawati, I can find her shortcomings. No matter how much I talk to her about those things, they're going to come up every day if I'm continually pointing to those things. But if I point to the fact that I am the aggregate of something, I'm impermanent. These conditions came together and created me. At some point in time, they're going to fall apart and she's gone. That's it. Somebody says, I'm living now and then I'm going to die. I'm thinking I'm dying now, and when I drop off this body, I will live. There will be a new life. So it just depends on how you look at it. Yeah? Mind is the forerunner of everything. Mind made are we. Whatever we think and ponder on, that becomes the inclination of our mind. So if I look outside and we were having a picnic and it's raining, it's two things. The first thing I can do is not be perturbed by the rain. If we're having a picnic, that means it's warm. At least I'll go out and I'll enjoy the warmth. Or we'll just come in and we'll eat. You know, we'll make the best of whatever it is today, because being upset about it just makes it worse. Or who knows, one day I might get that power to stop the rain. Yeah. I mean, all of us know of something that's extraordinary. In some ways, we're lower than a cat. Because a cat has a broad visual capacity. So my cat sees things I don't see. I'd say it's not there, but the cat is definitely playing with his imaginary friend. That cat is seeing something because his bandwidth is greater than mine. My dog, he hears things that I don't hear. Because I don't hear it, I say it doesn't exist. But why? Just because in my frame of reference, with my tool bag, I don't have the capacity to hear. But he hears it. You can hear somebody, no, way out at the curb. I don't hear it. So we can't say this world is only what we can see and what we can hear. But But with these practices, our capacities increase. And he talks about these kinds of supramundane capacities to read the minds of others. It's one of them, to have ears that can hear. You know, I had a master one time. I had to leave her. She had the gift she could hear 1,000 miles. I know you might not believe it. I don't care. But I'm just telling you, it was the truth. And I used to sneak out of the monastery, you know, to the Starbucks. And I would go out the back gate, and there's a fence, and I could lift a board, and I could go. And some others, we snuck out too, but I was the only one that would get in trouble. And she come, and I come back, and she'd be standing there at the board that I'm sneaking back in, and she'd tell me everything I said in the Starbucks about her, because I was over there talking about her. You know, so to tell me everything that I said, you know. And when I left her, I didn't talk until I was 1,000 miles, 1,000 miles away. My monk friend, he said, "I'm taking you back to Maryland, and if you want to come back out here, you can." Because she had developed, she had that capacity, but she wasn't like perfected in her virtue, you know. And so she used the abilities in a harmful way. And so a lot of these things I have experienced over my 50-year trek. Yeah. And I have come to know directly for myself that certain things are true. Not because they were within my field of reasoning. Not in my field of reasoning, but they are in my sphere of experience. Now, this is worth me giving my life for, because I'm coming to know something about natural law and the nature of the universe and my own capacities as a human being. And he came to tell me about them. And that the righteous law of the universe is virtue. So virtue is a power. We don't think of it as a power. We just think of it as something, do good, you know, that kind of thing. But it is actually a power. And if we realize that, then we understand causality. And we know that there is nothing that happens that should not happen. It happens because we create the conditions for these things to happen. And until we have a different view and perspective of what we can contribute in the world to create a different kind of world, we're going to be at the mercy of those who do things and who cause things to happen. You say, well, what power do I have? No, I can't do anything. And that's the mind says, if you think you can't, you can't. But if within your mind and heart, you think that you have a contribution that you can make to the shifting of the conditions of this world, then we're ready to get busy. I'm not going to tell you many more personal stories, but I could tell you a whole lot. And it's not because I just believe it. but it's because I could put into practice. First, you got to know what he said, and then put it into practice. As you put it into practice, you develop your own self-mastery. What time? It's 8:36. I got a clock right here. Well, they do have to keep up with the time for me, but they gave me a clock. So I'm really serious on this. The Buddha talked many places, and some felt within themselves this was what they were looking for. And they left home. They went out to him and never came back. One guy was getting married the next day, and he walked with the Buddha out to his camp, and he never went back. I mean, it's lots of stories like that. So I never tell these stories to people until they've been in the Dharma for a while, so that they don't get the wrong idea. You know, I don't tell those stories. But they heard something that rang true, that they bore witness to, that there was a capacity untapped and unleashed in them that they wanted to allow to arise and come forward. And it takes a certain kind of fearlessness for that to happen. It takes a certain level of love for that to happen. Now, Buddha didn't talk about love so much. He talked about non, N-O-N. So if you were hating, he would say non-hatred. If you want to know, do the opposite. Whatever you're feeling, do the opposite of that. Don't come up with some other words that make you like, I'm not sure exactly what that is. But use non. Hatred is overcome by non-hatred. So if you're experiencing hatred, you're feeling it, what's the opposite of that? I can't tell you what that is for you. I can only tell you what that is for me. But even if I tell you, you won't know it because you're not me. So it helps us to get real with ourselves and to really, really come face to face with ourselves, our habitual tendencies, our constant thoughts. And then he says, don't think like that, think like this. And it starts with thinking of this life like a dream. Thinking of this life like a mirage. Thinking of this life like a bubble. Thinking of this life like a shadow. You can see the shadow, you can see the bubble, but you can't grasp it. So it is and it isn't. And that's what's called the middle way. So in that the Prajnaparamita Sutra that I was reading said, form is none other than emptiness. Emptiness is none other than form. And he says, this appearance is false, but false doesn't mean not real. It means that it's only as it is, as we are compounded. And at some point, all of this starts to break apart and will become uncompounded, and that will be the end. It goes for us, it goes for buildings, it goes for cars, it goes for galaxies, it goes for universes, it goes for everything. And it says, if you have that kind of mind, you'll find that you'll be able to handle everything that comes your way. and you'll be able to see the beautiful in the ugly. And we won't get so high-minded that we can't see the ugly in the beautiful. And we end up with a non-differentiating mind. It's only because of differentiation that we struggle. That's what causes our unhappiness. The differentiating mind. But if we hold everything as it is and as it isn't, pretty soon you actually have a unified view. And you won't teeter on this side, like it, I don't like it, I want that, I don't want that. You'll be able to be with everything just like it is. Some things you have the power to change, you change. You just change it. Some things that you don't, you accept. And life becomes. He called it a state of mind called beautiful. So, tomorrow, if you have eye masks, bring it. If you have earplugs, I'll get a bunch of earplugs on the way home tonight. Can we do that? And you will see how easily you can drop into a particular state of contentment and be there. This doesn't have to take forever. You don't have to sit for hours. You don't have to walk for days. You know, and we do it in short sets, like 5 minutes, and then you come out. You go back in, 5 minutes, and you come out. Then you review what's happening in there. What are you experiencing? How quickly thoughts drop away, and how slowly new thoughts arise. Before you know it, you're sitting for 30 minutes, feels like 5 minutes. I think I wanna stop right there. I didn't really know that you didn't know about some things. So I'll be more informative tomorrow. And it's okay. It's okay. It's okay that you don't know. Because I want to tell you from the Dharma tomorrow. It's exciting to know something. And, you know, because especially if you've been practicing for a long time, say, this is good, but, you know, isn't there more? Is it more? Isn't there something greater? Don't you want it? Yeah. I don't worry about the numbers. Some not ready, no problem. Some ready. And if you're ready, I want to offer it. Tell you where to find it. I'll bring you references so you could look it up for yourself and study the Dharma in this way. We're going to close. And can you put on awakened mind? So I never know which way I'm going, whether I'm going silly or whether I'm going serious. But I'm really serious. I'm really serious tonight. I have a few CDs. We have a gospel choir. Because this is good news. So that a few CDs out, you can pick them up. Can you bring the lights down? Lights.
See you at 9:00.